Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This week, we are catching up on all the latest from the campaign trail, including some exciting policy joy.
We look forward to the next election to follow, the Labour leadership race, which people are already talking about.
And we talk about whether or not Theresa May is really campaigning in a sealed box, and whether or not that matters.
Plus, you ask us, is it time to stop using the word tribal? So,
the election, eh? How's that all working out?
I mean, it's not a vintage campaign, right? Yeah.
What I am enjoying, though, and I know this is a kind of odd thing to praise, is I am enjoying the kind of Labour crop sprayer approach to policies. It's just kind of, you know that episode of Oprah where she's like, and you get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car. I'm kind of enjoying that.
So actually, the interesting thing in terms of the polls is the recovery in Labour's vote share. Like, if the polls are borne out, this will be the largest share of the vote for the big two since 1992, which itself was something like a 20-year peak.
Caused by the collapse of UKIP and the pre-collapse of the Lib Dems, which is not turning into a great revival.
Yeah, the collapse of the Lib Dems, which is not unravelling as we perhaps expected it would. And then also, so the fascinating thing about the Greens in this election is, and it may turn out that they're like the anti-Lib Dems, in that they may be putting on votes in more useful places, and in some of the mayoral results it appeared that they might be. But the interesting thing is they keep talking about this progressive alliance. Now, obviously, causation and correlation aren't the same thing, but it is striking that the more talk of progressive alliance there is, the more the Green share drops in the polls, right? Because the problem is what you're actually shouting if you're a Green talking about a progressive alliance is you're going, we're irrelevant, we can't win, wouldn't you be better off voting for the Labour Party?
I think you and I are of one mind on the progressive alliance, right? It's like a way of shortcutting your way back to, like, maybe there's a way back that doesn't involve winning back some Tory voters or Scotland.
Yeah, and one of the subplots of the local elections was that actually the, I mean, obviously there are problems with the supplementary vote system, which make it more stark, but large numbers of Greens and Lib Dems second pref the Tories. You know, people, the problem with progressive alliances is basically a way that politicos talk down to, like, ordinary voters. People do understand that elections are fought between the Tories and whoever not the Tories are, unless you're lucky enough to live in a constituency where you get to pick your favourite non-Tory party. But people do kind of get that, right? If they choose to not vote for whatever the non-Tory party is, it's not because they've, you know, slipped and fallen in the ballot box.
Yeah, I think Sarah Dighton said this on Twitter, which was something about basically, it's not like they, you know, they tried to make the Labour Party and they got it slightly wrong several times, right? These are distinct parties with their own traditions and their own emphasis. And that's why people vote for them. People want the Greens, you know, they want their vote to be about, to say, I care about environmental issues, for example, or whatever it is. They don't just kind of go, I want someone who's not the Tories. That's not how people make their decisions. Anyway, let's talk policy, because you know how we love policy on this podcast. What about that old tuition fee pledge, Stephen?
So the tuition fee pledge is a bit,
I should probably
odd.
Explain what the tuition fee pledge is, right? I guess everyone's been living under a rock, which is Labour have confirmed what Jeremy Corbyn said during his first leadership election, which is that they want to scrap all tuition fees.
Yeah, so the day that we are recording is Education Day, and they started with a commitment to reverse the kind of planned cuts, and I presume, therefore, a commitment to not rolling out the new national funding formula paid for by reversing the corporation tax cut since 2010, and then £8 billion of infrastructure spend, which under the fiscal rule, they don't need to find money for because they have the ability to borrow for investment. So, you know, infrastructure, transport, buildings, yeah, basically anything. When you spend it once, you've got it forever, or, you know, at least until it needs some repairs. But they also then this afternoon, when and also tuition fees. The interesting thing about this, and obviously, you know, they've got their Clause 5 meeting tomorrow to discuss the full manifesto. And when it comes out, I will do the entertaining thing of going through and totting up how progressive or regressive it is in terms of who benefits. But I haven't closed my mind to the argument that particularly the 9K fee does make people act as if they are buying a qualification, not receiving an education, right? So there is definitely an argument to be made that the graduate contribution is too large now. And certainly in terms of marginal tax rates, you are sort of bumping up against the level where, because at the moment, a graduate on 25K was paying more in terms of their overall tax, you know, when you throw in national insurance, et cetera, they were paying more than a graduate on 9K is now. You know, there is an argument to be made about how you fund that, but it obviously is quite regressive. And my instinct is actually, if you want to, the National Education Service, which I think is a lovely idea, although I'm still not entirely sure what it is Labour wants, like in terms of the levers they all pull, I'm not quite sure if it gets to where they want to be. Then actually, I think the interesting thing is you really should be looking forward to extending people's ability to take time out of work and to go through education multiple times at life without taking on loan from banks that they have to pay off regardless of their ability to pay.
Yeah, it does seem a bit... now we have a workplace that's structured like it is and most people don't expect to work in the same job for the entirety of their lives. It is slightly... I mean, you can get career development loans from banks, right, that you have a certain amount of time to... You don't pay them off while you're still studying, but you then are still being charged, you know, a commercial rate of interest.
But one of the... I mean, obviously, like, Labour never fights a fair fight in a general election, right? But one of the slightly bizarro things about this election in particular is Labour is putting forward quite detailed proposals, which means then it's very easy to go, and obviously I used to go, I like that bit, I like that bit, I like this vision, that bit I don't like, and that bit I can take or leave. Whereas the Tory manifesto is basically...
Grammar schools, Brexit,
and
strong, and stable Theresa May.
I mean, you know, yeah, but it is sort of the most content-free...
Oh, and fox hunting.
And fox hunting, yeah. The most content-free programme.
Children should be allowed to go to selective schools where they can rip foxes apart with their bare hands. That's the true vision of...
Technically, I think you might be able to rip a fox apart with your bare hands.
I believe that if you kill any animal with a spinal column inhumanely... That is a technically a prosecutable offence because you're not even supposed to kill mice with those glue traps where it breaks their spine. Fact.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I once lived in a house with a terrible mouse problem, and actually in the end we had to get someone come around who feeds them a poison that also, it's like got formaldehyde in it, so it also mummifies them. So the trouble with that is great because it kills the mice, but also you do find tiny, quite adorable looking, but very stiff mice staring at you from bits of like from a countertop for weeks afterwards.
So this is increasingly why I kind of regard not living in flats as innately uncivilized. So obviously I grew up in a flat. I live in a flat. I actually live, yeah, they are, you know, kind of late 50s, early 60s council build. So they are basically identical in terms of their shape and size and layout. And obviously the big thing they all have in common, which kind of confused me when he was like, I choose when I take the bins out. And it's like, oh yeah, people who don't live in flats don't have a magical chute. And you like put your waste in and then it's the council's problem.
This is Philip May.
Yeah, Philip May in his one show interview was like, oh, you know, when I put the bins out, and it's just like, oh yeah, people who live on the bare earth. I'm just like, ugh.
London just gives you a very weird view of the concept of bins. Because where I used to live in glorious Islington in Emily Thornberry's fiefdom, there were no wheelie bins because it was a flat that went directly, like a series of flats went onto pavement, and they picked up your bins every day.
But also, it means like animals can get inside. I mean, yeah, because we're, you know, fairly high up, we'd have to work quite hard to get some form of infestation, right?
I think you might one day live to eat those words, because if there's one thing I can tell you about mice, it's that little buggers can get anywhere. Anyway, enough about my rodent problems. Now I have wheelie bins. So I'm, you know, like, I watch Mrs. Brown's Boys, that chat show. I have a wheelie bin. I'm incredibly in touch with Middle
England.
Is that
why you're becoming a Tory?
I'm not becoming a Tory. Oh my.
Anyway, but yeah, on the subject of the actual Tories, so yeah, they...
It's fine. This isn't like people... If you said that to me on Twitter, then I'd be drowning and people calling me a slug for the next couple of weeks. But, it's, you know, people on... Turns out, actually, people who listen to our podcast are able to comprehend whole sentences rather than just angrily mashing the keyboard.
Yeah, but...
Can we talk about the Labour leadership?
Yes. So, obviously, the slightly bizarre thing about this election is that you talk to most people from most parts of the Labour Party, and they'll kind of go like, you know, on the record, here's what I'm, you know, here's our plan to like win this seat, win this election. And then afterwards they're like, but anyway, on to business. Let's talk about the big fight we're planning to have on the morning of the 9th June for control of the wreckage of the Labour Party. And that conversation got a bit of a boost this week because Jim Waterson at BuzzFeed did an interview with Jeremy Corbyn in which he said, no, if I lose, I'm sticking around.
He said, I was elected leader and I'll carry on being leader or something like that. It was definitely a formulation that was, I mean, in that circumstance, you'd normally expect somebody to say, I'm all about winning, or I don't deal in hypotheticals. I think those are the kind of two classic. Because that happened, people would ask Salmon the same during the Scottish referendum, right? If you lose, will you step down as leader of the SNP? And he went, you know, I don't talk in hypotheticals.
And
yes,
and,
I guess I will.
And Brown and Miliband did both kind of do sort of,
I won't stand down, I'm carrying on,
et cetera, et cetera. And actually, you know, Ed did sort of kind of, well, it is contested, but it's fairly certain that Ed did, they were operating in the leader's office under the idea that if they got 250 to 270 seats, Ed would stick around for another go in 5 years' time. So,
but this also has an overtone to it, doesn't it? Which is that there is an increasing feeling that actually Jeremy Corbyn's leader ratings are so bad that he is in some ways a drag on the Labour vote. And that, I mean, like I said, somebody said to me, you know, I want to vote Labour, but unless they lose really badly, he won't go. And I think that's a factor in this leadership election. And actually, in terms of where Corbyn has been campaigning, he was in my hood of Worcester this week, in front of the Guildhall, which has got a Tory majority of over 5,000 now. And actually, there is a thing that people in marginal seats, A, don't want to take time out from campaigning to do a photo call that will get a nib in the local paper, and C, some people just don't feel that he is a drag on them and they don't want to be seen with him in their seat. So I think he's finding it, in some respects, quite hard to find people who are genuinely happy to see him.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, obviously he's naturally warm on the campaign trail. He enjoys campaigning. So I think he's enjoying the kind of like on the ground stuff. Yeah, obviously the Times had a sort of hit on the fact that even his loyalists mostly aren't putting him on their leaflets. But the reason why this is all more intense, because obviously Miliband and Brown were drags on the ticket in 2010 and 2015. The reason why it's more intense is that Brown's legitimacy solely flowed through the parliamentary party. They were the only people who got to elect him ever, right? So his legitimacy flowed through them and therefore flowed through the general election. Ed came in through a fix in Labour's electoral college, basically. But again, his legitimacy he saw as flowing through Parliament. There's actually quite a sophisticated argument underlying the row between Corbynites and Corbyn sceptics, which is like, from where does Jeremy's legitimacy come from? Does it exist solely within the structures of the party? Is there a kind of composite of, does it come from the country and the party, or should it solely emanate through the structures of parliamentary democracy and the rights of nomination and control of Labour MPs? And the reason why people are more nervous about Jeremy going, yeah, I'll stay, is because his critics sort of think that he is very firmly in the my legitimacy flows through the party. Although actually, when you talk to most Labour MPs, particularly, I would say most Labour MPs who are active in their own constituencies, you know, like live there or are from there, you have a kind of a, they are not relaxed about the prospects of a leadership race. They think it will be difficult. They, you know, they're not sure if there are existing people who might join to vote for Jeremy Corbyn who have not already joined. But they actually kind of feel like, look, Labour members did not enjoy like the options put before them. Owen Smith ran a bad campaign, but actually people are worried about the election. And if we lose and lose badly, most people will not climb back aboard the Corbyn train.
Which I'm now firmly on team hashtag he should stay until the autumn if he loses, because I think there's a couple of things. I think probably you just need, you know, that Emma Miliband immediate resignation was actually kind of, it just threw another weight of instability into the mix at the time when the party already didn't need it. I think people need a bit of time to mourn if there is an election defeat. And I also think that if they do have the McDonnell Amendment, which gets through, which I already think is pretty questionable in the circumstances, then a very bad sign for the next Labour leader is if they cannot beat everyone else. You know, if somebody from the centre can't beat a candidate from the hard left, whatever you want to call it, that's not a great sign about their campaigning abilities, right? As evidenced last time round.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you say, the chances of the McDonnell Amendment making it through the conference floor look remote to me. The thing we kind of do sort of forget a lot whenever we talk about the Labour Party, and not just us, but basically every commentator on Labour, sort of from, you know, kind of from the sort of right-wingiest of Blairites all the way to your kind of sort of like hammer and sickle wavers, is there is this quite important thing in the Labour movement called the trade unions. If he can get an increase in the Labour vote or hold on to the what Ed did and outperform the polls, say get 180, 200 something seats, then possibly he can stay. But actually, one, I don't think the membership is going to go again. I definitely don't think the general secretaries are going to go again. And the difficulty for the left is they're already failing to get their stuff through the structures of the party as it is. Mm. If he loses, the NEC will become more hostile, partly because there is going to be some rebalancing on the NEC, because at the moment Unite, who are generally pro-Corbyn, have got an outsized representation, because as the trade unions have merged, that has increased their dominance. So that will change the balance there. The big variable in this, though, of course, is who he faces. My read from going around the country and talking to local members and, you know, doing events and that kind of thing is that if you kind of just had like candidate A and I knew nothing about them, I'd go, that candidate will beat Jeremy Corbyn if he loses and there is a leadership election. However, seeing as we know that there is not candidate A, the overwhelmingly likely candidate is Yvette Cooper. I mean, Yvette's already run against him and lost. And I imagine will run a campaign on the idea that Labour lost because it didn't have enough mugs with control on immigration on them. And then it's tricky to see, she could win. Not least because we shouldn't forget that a lot of people did pay £25 to vote for someone not called Corbyn. Yeah, considering how few people know who Owen Smith or Angela Eagle are, in terms of your ability to recruit more people to the Labour leadership election, there's a strong case to be made that we are at or near peak Corbyn. We are definitely not at or near peak Corbyn sceptic. So yeah, it's an interesting context. Obviously, they've kind of tried to dampen down the is he staying, is he going sort of row. In my other instinct is the weird thing with the Labour leadership election they are all preparing for, but none of them want to talk about, is that the side that talks about it most and triggers the most conversations about who leads the Labour Party is hurting themselves in the Labour leadership race. And of course, the other variable in terms of when he stands down is it's possible that Tom Watson won't come back.
Well, he has got a majority of, 9,000 and then a UKIP vote of 7,000? I mean, that's very roughly, but, you know, there is a... He wouldn't need a... You know, it's not impossible that the UKIP vote in Bromwich could collapse and then also he could have some Labour Tory switches given the kind of swings we've seen, right?
Basically, every Labour MP you talk to basically goes, oh, I think I'll be fine, but... And then they'll name some of their mates. You know, they're in trouble. And you're like, you've just named someone with exactly the same demographics and majority as you. So we kind of don't really know what the Labour Party will look like. We don't know who the surviving candidates will be. And it could be that the polls are wrong in a different direction. The increase in Labour's vote share could continue. There are just so many weird variables, but at the moment...
Well, there's also seat-by-seat variables, right? There also, we just do not at the moment know what effect, you know, a Lib Dem lack of revival would have in some seats.
Yeah, but at the moment, my working assumption is that there will be a leadership election and it will be contested between Jeremy Corbyn and Yvette Cooper. And then...
Oh, no, Stephen, no, I can't, please. I might have to, I don't know, I might have to retire to a nunnery or something. I can't cover a third Jeremy Corbyn-based leadership election. Oh, it's just, I mean, so I did a show this week with Aisha Hazarika, who's a former Labour special advisor. And it was really noticeable in it that there weren't that many Corbyn-friendly people in the room, which, is not unreasonable because Aisha comes very much from the centre-left, you know, worked for Harriet Harman. But I feel like now the people who, the tide is slightly going out on the Corbyn movement to some extent. And actually a lot of the people who would see themselves as kind of lifelong Labour members who were also very fond of Corbyn, I feel like that segment has been quietening down quite significantly. So I feel like now a lot of the encounters that I have with people who are Corbyn supporters are people who probably were like anarchists 5 years ago, who are a lot more unpleasant. And I don't know if that's purely a sort of social media, Facebook, Twitter artifact, but I do feel that actually the composition of the Corbyn vote it has changed a bit in the last year.
Well, I think I would partially agree with that. I think, yeah, the kind of important thing about Labour members is, you know, like the clue is in the title. When bad stuff happens, the kind of the family and the collective bunkers down and solidifies behind the leader. And I would say most Labour activists are firmly in that place, including people who didn't vote for him. However, I mean, I think we shouldn't forget that even in 2016, a majority of Labour members didn't think that he was competent and didn't think he could win. They weren't, however, convinced by what was on offer, and they were very angry about the skullduggery around the attempt to remove him without a contest.
Well, that is the big lesson, isn't it? Is it's not enough to try and convince people that Corbyn isn't right to be leader. You do have to sort of have to convince people that you are right to be leader.
Yeah, and in some ways, there is an exact parallel with the state of the country. And to be honest, in terms of the average person on Labour's centre-left, I think they have the same problem in their diagnosis of both, which is that it's not enough to have a plausible diagnosis of why the Conservative approach has failed or why Corbynism is not going to lead to a Labour majority. Unless once you've pointed that out, you have an incredibly compelling counter-offer, you're just a moaner, and no one likes moaners.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's talk about your column this week, because it's something that we've discussed a few times before, but I think it is really interesting what's happening in this election. So I think we might have mentioned that Theresa May might as well be kind of campaigning in a hermetically sealed, I would say palanquin, but I don't know if that's actually how that word's pronounced, because I've only read it in Ian M. Banks novels, so it's possible that it has a much jazzier pronunciation than that.
What's that?
It's like there's in the culture novels, I'm getting confused with Alistair Reynolds' novels, my hard sci-fi, I'm getting mixed up. Like a locked litter, right?
Like a box.
No, but like, you know, the way that kind of senators and stuff would have been carried around on poles on people's shoulders, but in a box.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, like a sedan chair, but an upgraded version of that. Didn't you study history?
Yeah,
but... How do you not know about sedan chairs? That's like a 90% of history.
Yeah, but I only really kind of did sort of one kind of medieval paper. I mainly did sort of like, you know, French Revolution, Luther, you know, the interesting stuff. You know, I basically, if they haven't invented the printing press, but everyone's not dead, right? You kind of want that, like, that sweet spot between 1500 and, like, 1830 and everything else.
Okay, but I'm pretty sure that people would have had a palanquin in them that bit.
But anyway, she's campaigning in a sealed box.
In a kind of, yeah, hermetically sealed box. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, to his credit, has been out actually, you know, having kind of mini rallyettes and stuff like that. Tim Farron did get shouted at by a very angry man in the street and went on a hovercraft as well, which looked quite fun. So at least he's enjoying himself. But, you know, people have said this is a sort of non-election campaign, and your column made a kind of counter-argument to that.
Well, yeah. So The kind of the fascinating question, which I don't sort of answer one way or the other in the column because I don't know, is that the Conservatives have gradually been refining the voter out of their election campaigns since about 2005, really. Like, they have just found more and more ways of not putting the candidate in front of any real voters. And you just focus on your actual audience, which is on TV, radio, and Facebook, right? And you kind of do a bit of stuff for the local papers, but the main thing you do is you just buy advertising in them because
they need the money.
Yeah, they're mostly so broke and they just really can't turn it down. And so the weird thing is, so are they fighting an election campaign? Yes, but it isn't even really an election campaign than you would, than someone, yeah, if you put an election strategist asleep in 2001 and, you know, we're like, now you run this, they'd go, oh, this is a bit weird, isn't it? You know, so we forget in 2000.
They'd be really freaked out by Facebook. Yeah. What? Everyone's posting photos of their babies on the internet?
And yeah, we forget in 2001, sort of, okay, obviously Labour won by loads, but they did have, you know, awkward encounters with real non-vetted voters. Now, obviously, Jeremy is doing something very different. He's going out and meeting people and not just sort of a kind of, yeah, chosen activist. So he, you know, he met people at the National Head Teachers Union. Now, I know that a certain type of our listener will go, oh, but, you know, a union. I mean, yeah, again, I know I said sort of.
Yeah, but they can be quite feisty teachers.
And also, unions aren't innately left wing, and head teachers unions even more yeah. So, right? A majority of head teachers voted for the Conservatives last time around. But the kind of fascinating thing is I can't work out, is Jeremy Corbyn meeting actual voters and focusing on this kind of more bespoke approach to campaigning, is it going to look as antiquated as like Winston Churchill kicking off his campaign at Walthamstow Dogs Track with a big crowd, or kind of Attlee in 1955 being like, television? What is campaigning on the television? You know,
I think it's enormously inefficient, right? I mean, that's the thing about meeting real people, is that you can only meet real people in the hundreds at a time, whereas you can bulk buy advertising online for hundreds of thousands, and television, you know, being on BBC One, you can reach millions. So I watched Theresa May and Philip May on The One Show, and we've got a piece by Roger Mosey, who used to work at the BBC, going out tonight, in which he is really questions the BBC's decision to do this, because he says, you know, politicians are always desperate to use bits of the BBC that aren't the political programming, right? Because they know that's where the normal people are. So people were always, I think Tony Blair really wanted to get on Match of the Day, he said, and they had to try and block that. David Cameron eventually snuck onto the Chris Evans breakfast show to talk about the Olympics because he had a personal contact with somebody who worked on the show. But the BBC has generally been historically pretty opposed to cozy sofa chats, because that is just seen as another form of advert. And that's really what Theresa May's One Show appearance was. It was an advert for the concept that Theresa May is a human being with human emotions. So they talked her through her wedding photos. They did, you know, Philip May, did you fancy her when you first saw her? Theresa May, tell us a relatable anecdote about shoes, which is your thing you have that's a sign of you having a personality. And, you know, totally policy free. It was just a lifestyle interview. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is going to get the same thing, although Laura is not going to be on there with him. But it was quite, if I was CCHQ, I'd be delighted with it. But it was quite a strange thing to have happened.
So this is going to be one of those long rambling things, because I have two sharply contrasting opinions and I can't reconcile. So my instinct is that people are, and you can shout about till you're blue in the face. And in terms of the other thing which has happened this week, which is election expenses, right? People vote for a prime minister. They vote for the party they want to run the country. A couple of people, but they are mostly not significant even in their own constituency, let alone nationwide, vote for a local candidate. But most people don't. And they are kind of buying the idea of the person in the round. And people do kind of care about how it is these people are when they're not just, you know, instructing the MOD. So I'm kind of for it, because it's such a key part of how people make decisions. Then I kind of think you should kind of give people more opportunities to do it.
Okay, here's something I'm only going to say in the safe space of the podcast as well. I think Philip May might be my problematic fave.
Why?
Because he just seemed, and I know this is, he just seemed really chilled out with the concept of being a man who's married to the Prime Minister. And you know how, like, there's a whole thing about, oh, Dennis Thatcher was so strong and supportive, but it was also seen as being like, how terrible for Dennis that, you know, he should be so emasculated in this role. He's going to have to, you know, send anguish letters to Bill Deeds. Philip May is just a man going his own way. You know, he's just doing his own thing. He's fine. He's, you know, chilling out. He's got his own stuff on. He puts the bins out, whatever. I liked that. There's not very many nice things I have to say about you know, the whole Theresa May image, but that is kind of one of them.
Yeah, so I mean, like, he obviously is like a good political spouse, partly because so the fascinating thing that sort of everyone will tell you about focus groups is you focus group Yvette Cooper or Ed Balls. And people sort of all right with them. And then you kind of go, by the way, do you know one of them is married to the other? And people are like, I don't like that. Because people don't like MPs and they don't think that it is, you know, they think it's
That's really funny. Someone I was talking to, a Labour politician, said, you know, it's really interesting. When you go round on your own as an MP, and this person wasn't an MP anymore, when you go round on your own as an MP, people are really cool with you. But as soon as you get joined by another MP, then you're politicians, right? And that's when you start getting kind of heckled and people think that you're not like this representative of this hated political class. And it's this sort of strange thing where you're more than the sum of your parts if you just put one MP and put another MP together.
Yeah, and so, you know, he also started with political ambitions and he had... Yeah, they are a stronger political unit because their joint ambitions funnel through her than they, I mean, ditto the Clintons, right? Yeah, like, yeah, people don't like it and they're kind of a bit uneasy about it. Yeah, I mean, so I think it's, I can understand why Lara doesn't want to do it, but I think it is a shame because I think Jeremy will do very well in all of the kind of, you know,
he'll
Desert
be
Island Discs.
Great
talking
at the
about,
one show because like, he'll talk about, they'll like bring on a marrow, he'll talk about his allotment, you know, he'll make some jokes about El Gato, you know, they'll say, do you find it difficult to deal with all the negative press attention? And he'll go, well, it is a bit tricky, but you know, it's a great privilege, which is kind of what Philip May did. You know, it's, I think it'd be fine.
I think the interesting thing as well in the election campaign is Downing Street have agreed to do a question and answer session on Question Time with ordinary members of the people. Ordinary members of the people.
Yeah, that's very Theresa May. You know, that's the will of the people. She will have to hear from them.
But she hasn't done Question Time since 2011. She doesn't react to difficult questions in a way that I would say was polite.
Yeah, I think some poor kind of like Bob from Chippenham is about to kind of get sent away with a flea in his ear. I mean,
yeah.
He asked a difficult question
and
about
again,
something she doesn't like.
You can argue about whether or not this is the correct way to view politics, but most people do kind of think that they're the customers and the politicians are the thing they're buying, and you've got to be polite to the customers. And Jeremy does have a flash of temper with journalists, but with random members of the public, he's quite patient and folksy. So I wouldn't be... And my strong priority is basically, if people don't like your leader... They have one opportunity to fix that, which is the TV debates, which is when people start paying attention and they kind of give you a second look. If I was miles ahead, why would you agree to a debate? I think you should.
My problem is but with Jeremy Corbyn is that I think someone might be mean to him and he might be a bit woolly in response, which I find kind of quite sweet and adorable. But there is a difficult line that people also want a leader to be strong. So I think they certainly don't want someone they feel has kind of rolled over on that.
Yeah. I mean, I can see how both of them would come a cropper at certain bits, but I just think Jeremy's serenity will see him through, probably.
Monsieur Zen, as we found out that his nickname is this week.
Yeah.
Monsieur Zen is fine. Well, if you're listening, Jeremy Corbyn, give our love to El Gato and indeed to your giant marrow. And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
Yes, see, you're getting into the spirit at last. I knew I would wear you down.
I have learned to love Big Brother.
It's from Michael Gorman, who emailed in to say, is it time to retire the word tribal applied to political party? He thinks it's used mostly of Labour supporters in order basically to try and bully them into saying that you shouldn't instinctively feel affinity with Labour as a political party. You should make your decisions in a quote-unquote rational way. What do you think?
So I agree very strongly with this obviously he has now stood down, but throughout like the kind of Stoke on Trent by-election, there was a lot of coverage where it was like, oh, people down there would vote for a chip if it voted Labour. It's just like, I mean, Stokes Council is run by Conservatives and Independents, so proof by convincing counterexample. And just kind of this nonsense about like, oh, round there, like, yeah. Or for example, the fact that the Tees Valley was a big shock to everyone. But actually, the Tees Valley was only a percentage point more Labour than the West Midlands mayoral race was, right? Like, okay, the Tories had taken the West Mids more seriously. They'd spent more money and they had a better candidate. But only the fact that it's like, oh, Middlesbrough, they don't have any Tories there. And it's like, well, first past the post is a hell of a drug. But yeah, if you look at George Osborne, right, a man who, let's face it, you could not claim was doing his job as a constituency MP, right?
I think you should take that back. I mean, I think he's been past Tatton maybe three or four times on his way to somewhere else while he was MP for there.
But, you know, between, you know, BlackRock, you know, his full-time job as Evening Standard editor, his speeches, his...
I think he got some American
McCain
job as well.
Fella. I mean, like, the idea that he was in any way representing the people of Tatton...
They had a lot of strong thoughts about their roofing situations.
..is a joke. But if he'd still been the candidate, he would have won, right? The people of Tatton voted, like, 18,000 of them voted for Neil Hamilton in 1997. No one ever goes like, lol, they would vote for a dog with a blue rosette round here. And yet, it is palpably equally true of...
I feel like a dog with a blue rosette would have been a measurably better and cuter MP than Neil Hamilton.
Yeah, and we shouldn't forget the Conservatives got 30% of the vote in 1997. So, yeah, I do feel that there are a lot of kind of assumptions, and particularly when you get about the way people talk about specific groups of Labour voters, it's freighted with kind of classism and the kind of, you know, slightly racist language about, you know, like them getting out the Asian vote, etc., all of which I think is a bit ugly.
I also think that the Tories are capable at parliamentary level of acting incredibly tribally. The classic example is maybe recently being Chris Grayling's, like, we can't hand over Southern to be operated by TfL, even though that would integrate it much better with London's rail network, even though TfL are patently capable of running a railway line in a way that the Southern franchise holders aren't, because that's, we think that Boris Johnson's going to lose the mayoralty and that means Labour will be in charge of it, and we don't like that.
Yeah, I think the one thing it is useful about is explaining the ways and reasons why Labour act, because I don't think there's that much of a difference between voters. I do, however, think there is a massive difference between activists, because I don't think that's really tribalism. That's just like, you know, like crude and aggressive partisanship, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is quite different. Whereas Labour MPs and Labour Party members do have an affection for Labour as an entity that I don't think Liberal Democrat and Conservative MPs and members have for their respective parties.
Ooh, controversial.
And I think that there, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I suspect, all things being equal, whatever happens after the 8th of June, Labour will survive in one piece, albeit a small and fractious one. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Helen Lewis. We're produced by India Book and mixed by James Shields. Our music is by the Underscore Orchestra and is licensed under Creative Commons. If you'd like to see even more of Helen, she's chairing The American Carnage, asking whether or not Donald Trump really will destroy the world or just a small part of it. She's doing that on Monday, the 22nd of May. You can find out more details and book tickets at newstatesman.com/events.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.